I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters. Every week, we like to begin the show with a review of recent health media coverage. On the line from St. Paul, Minnesota is Gary Schweitzer of healthnewsreview.org. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. It's fun to join you, John.
I want to start by asking you, there was a paper in Public Library of Science, PLOS, I think as some people call it, media coverage of medical journals. Do the best articles make the news?
Well, the clear answer from the researchers, and I agree with them, is a resounding no. Really interesting paper. I really admire what they did. What they found was that major newspapers were more likely to cover observational studies, which I'll explain in a minute, and less likely to cover randomized clinical trials. So I think we have to appreciate that a study is not a study is not a study. Not all studies are equal. If you could do a randomized clinical trial, you would do it because it is higher in the pyramid, higher in the hierarchy of evidence. Yet, journalists were more inclined to report on a weaker, still important, but weaker type of study called observational studies, which cannot prove cause and effect. They can give you a very strong statistical association, but they can't prove cause and effect. So these researchers said that they felt they had shown a clear systematic bias on the part of journalists to cover weaker studies. And not only were they covering observational studies more than the higher quality randomized clinical trials, but when they did cover observational studies, they chose weaker observational studies. So a very important finding, but not at all surprising to us with what we found in our Health News Review project. I was very happy to see that the authors of the paper cited one of our blog posts where we talked about botched news coverage of a study that showed a statistical association between statin drug use, these cholesterol-lowering statin drugs, between the use of those drugs and fewer deaths from cancer. A lot of stories that we saw just simply got it wrong, reporting that statins helped fight cancer or lowered the risk of dying from cancer or extended the lives of cancer patients. All of those verbs, all of those phrases emphasize cause and effect. That kind of study cannot establish cause and effect. Just as an example, one story got it right. Reuters Health reported, because this study was an observational study, the slightly lower cancer death rates could have been caused by factors other than the statin itself. That was just 24 words. All it took was 24 words, and it injected important accuracy into that Reuters story. Now, what was interesting was the day after I wrote about that study of media coverage, the BMJ, which is what the British Medical Journal used to be called, that's what it stands for, but it now goes by the BMJ, sent out a news release on a paper in one of the journals that it publishes, not in the BMJ itself, but one in their stable. And the headline of that news release was that hormone replacement therapy cuts the risk of repeat knee or hip replacement surgery by 40%.
Wow.
Well, that is simply not what the study showed, because again, it was an observational study, not equipped to show that anything, quote, cut risk. Proof of cutting risk would be proof of cause and effect, and this observational study in question couldn't do that. Now, you can't blame the researchers. They didn't use cause and effect language. They wrote hormone replacement therapy is associated with an almost 40% reduction. That's accurate. It was the news release writers who got it wrong. And it was only two words, John. Cuts risk. But those two words were inaccurate and terribly misleading. So your audience, I hope, can back up for a minute and just think about the food chain of how misinformation on healthcare is conveyed to the public. It could be the researchers who get it wrong. It could be the PR people for their medical center who wrote it up and got it wrong. It could be the journal's peer reviewers or their editors who let bad science go unaddressed. It could be the PR people for the journal, which it was in this case. It could be marketing people for a drug company. It could be the journalists.
I'm interested about a study showing fist bumps as safer than handshakes. Makes sense to me. Spread fewer germs, right? I mean, is that something we can hang our hat on?
Well, there's no question that, you know, the issue of in-hospital infection control is really important. You know that better than I do. But this was a silly little study of whether fist bumps between hospital workers was better than handshakes. It got all kinds of news coverage. And, John, it was based on a study size of two. Two people going around doing fist bumps or handshakes.
Two people?
Now, two people. There's a surgeon blogger who goes by the name of the Skeptical Scalpel, and he's actually the one who uncovered this, and he wrote, "What we have here is a study of a whopping two subjects that showed no significant difference for bacterial growth or contact time between the handshake versus the fist bump." Also, he wrote, "I wonder how many times a day do hospital workers shake hands with each other? My guess would be zero." Well, what kind of news coverage? The NBC Today show had five anchors on the set doing a silly fist-bumping scene, sort of celebrating this study of two people. ABC's Dr. Richard Besser did his own experiment, handshake versus high-five versus fist bump, but he did it with a sample of one himself, and he never acknowledged the earlier published study, almost making it look like he dreamed up the research question. As the Skeptical Scalpel blogger wrote, this was a story that gained legs because it was sensationalized. And you know what? From my perspective, I think it got the news coverage because it had fist bump in the headline.
So medicine, as much an art as a science. We're trying to make it a science.
Absolutely. And you know, it doesn't take much to scrutinize studies and coverage of studies to get at what the evidence really shows or doesn't show.
Gary Schweitzer, always associating with truth in journalism. He's our go-to guy here for separating the wheat from the chaff. Gary, we'll talk to you next week. Thanks so much.
Look forward to it.
Gary Schweitzer has been covering health news for almost four decades. He currently blogs at healthnewsreview.org. This is Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. And of course, there's no bigger news story in the realm of healthcare than the implementation of Obamacare. That's where my next guest comes in. Politics aside, imagine having to turn Obamacare into real policy that affects tens, if not hundreds of millions of us. It would take great gumption and a very solid, rational mind to evaluate hundreds of competing ideas every week to imagine the most fair and balanced policies, like the very popular one that allows children up to age 26 to stay on their parents' insurance plans. Today, we're speaking with Sherry Gleed, a health economist and dean of the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University. From 2010 to 2012, she served as Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services for Planning and Evaluation, quite literally the hot seat in Washington from which key Obamacare policies emanated. Sherry Gleed, welcome to Medical Matters.
Thank you.
I want to start by asking you about this issue brief that you authored for the Commonwealth Fund titled "How States Stand to Gain or Lose Federal Funds by Opting In or Out of the Medicaid Expansion," kind of a long title. How would you, I guess, summarize the thrust of that? Because at this point, I mean, how many states are opting into Medicaid expansion and how many are sitting out so far?
So there are some that are still on the fence. 25 states in D.C. are expanding, so the others are out. So 25 are out and 26 are in.
And for a non-economist audience, but of good lay people, I mean, what do you think is at stake? I mean, why would states choose not to opt in to Medicaid expansion? I mean, what's the thinking there? Maybe it's not even understandable, but can you take a try at it?
Well, it's a good question. And I think there are really, to be generous to the states that have chosen not to opt in, I think, two answers. One is, from a pure state government perspective, if you are the state governor or legislature, it's clear that opting into the expansion in the out years, not in the early years, because in the early years the federal match is 100%, but after 2020, you would have to pay 10% of the cost of the expansion. So you will incur some cost stretching out into infinity by opting into the expansion. And states that are very reluctant to raise taxes or do anything else might be concerned about that 10% cost, which is extending out into the future. So that's one piece. The second piece is, some states are dubious that the federal government will keep its side of the bargain, and they are afraid that they're now signing up for a 10% share, but maybe that will devolve into a 30 or 40% share, and it will be hard for them to leave the program once they have decided to participate. I think there is actually no experience of that shift in the federal share in that direction, but that is a concern that they have.
Is it true, though, I mean, so I guess politically speaking, once a state decides to expand, they're not necessarily under any obligation to continue in the Medicaid program, but of course, once the genie's out of the bottle, it's very difficult to put it back in and would probably seem inhumane as well.
Right. So I think that's the concern that states expressed, that if they decided to expand and then subsequently they discovered that it was too costly for them, it would be very challenging to pull back. And in fact, to be fair, when you look at the existing Medicaid program, there have been modest pullbacks at various times, but relatively few big ones, although there have even been, you know, cases where states have expanded and then gone backwards. Tennessee is an example. So it's not impossible, but it's certainly difficult.
What did Tennessee do to pull backwards?
Well, so Tennessee had done a big Medicaid expansion in the 1990s, and then they felt that it was too expensive, and so they canceled it, and a lot of people fell off Medicaid.
This was the 10-CARE program?
Yes. I think it was Son of 10-CARE. It wasn't the original 10-CARE, it was another version of it.
So you were involved as Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at Health and Human Services with, let's see, the law was created, so you were involved really in evaluation and implementation of the law, is that?
Right, in writing the regulations and in implementing the law and designing the evaluations that will follow along.
So what was some of the thinking? I mean, was the Medicaid language all spelled out very clearly in the legislation itself as to the parameters of income levels and whatnot?
Yes. So the Medicaid language was all spelled out, including the federal shares and all of that. But you'll remember that there was a Supreme Court litigation. So the original Medicaid language said that if a state chose not to participate in the expansion, they were at risk of losing all of their Medicaid funding. The Supreme Court, you may remember, decided that that was too onerous a burden and that all that the federal government could hold at risk, in effect, was the federal funding for the expansion population, not for the entire Medicaid population. And because of that, it became feasible for states to decide not to participate. If it had not been for the Supreme Court ruling, it's extremely unlikely that any state would have given up its entire existing Medicaid program to lodge a protest against the Affordable Care Act.
Right, of course, because there's so many, in addition to taking individuals off of insurance rolls and out of the health-insured population, there's all kinds of downstream consequences, such as, you know, hospitals' ability to hit revenue targets, et cetera.
Right.
And, I mean, I think that's a real consideration going forward.
Yes, but in terms of the original program, the even greater concern was that the elderly population and nursing home populations would be devastated if Medicaid disappeared, since a very large share of the Medicaid, of the existing Medicaid budget, goes to disabled people and nursing home residents.
Yeah, so say a word about that in terms of the nursing home population, because where I see this in the hospital world, lots of times a nursing home is in a way a luxury that's unaffordable, unless for most families, and then those that could afford it often do the so-called spend down in order to get their loved
one. Right, so I mean, there's a lot of dispute about how many people spend down and how many people whatever don't spend down, but I think the key is that we think of Medicaid and certainly the Medicaid expansion is about low-income, working-age adults and children, but if you actually look at the Medicaid spend right now, about two-thirds of it goes to people who are either disabled or elderly. So right now, most of the spending in Medicaid is for disabled and elderly people. This expansion is really for the adult population.
And this is why the expansion of Medicaid, I guess, in the 90s and early 2000s with CHIP, you know, children's health insurance plans in states, that was pretty easy because it wasn't a huge financial hit and it's doing the right thing by covering, you know, virtually all children that are eligible.
Right, exactly. So kids, I think that part of the reason that everyone was pretty sanguine about the Medicaid expansion is that CHIP had been such a huge policy success. Everybody loved it, Republican governors and Democratic governors alike. So there was a sense that we had done something very similar to this with fairly high match rates and the governors had decided to participate and we could do it again. But it turned out that times had changed, or maybe because the population is different.
Do you foresee most or all states eventually opting in to the Medicaid expansion? Is it?
I do, and that was sort of the point of the issue brief. I guess the thing to realize and the main sort of lesson that we pointed out in the issue brief is that if you look at the program as it's designed, in 2021, states have to pay 10% of the cost of the Medicaid program, which means 90% of the cost of the Medicaid program is paid by the federal government. But the federal government doesn't have money. It collects the money from citizens in the states. And so what in effect happens is that if your state decides not to participate in the Medicaid program, you don't get exempted from the federal taxes that pay for 90% of the Medicaid program. So that money is still being raised as part of general revenues, except now it's all leaving your state and going to other states. So the cost to states of not participating is not only that they don't get their share of the federal money, but they also do pay their share of the federal cost to all the other states. So the great beneficiaries of states not participating, the great beneficiaries of Texas not participating in the Medicaid expansion, are taxpayers in California and New York who now don't have to pay taxes for the Texas expansion, while Texas taxpayers are paying taxes for the California and New York expansions. That's kind of a situation you don't think is going to persist forever.
No, you don't. And I guess the question that it leads me to, and I know you're an economist, but it's more of a political question, is why do you think there isn't more advocacy, I suppose, on behalf of either but people who would potentially be Medicaid eligible, demanding, in a sense, their rights under the law, or, you know, in terms of fiscal hawks saying, hey, our state is essentially losing in this the way this has been set up?
Well, I think, turning to the second group first, many of them just hate the expansion period, so they would like the whole thing to go away, and I guess they're still holding out hope that it will. I suspect that once the expansions are actually formally in place and lots of people are enrolled all around the country and maybe another election or two happens and the whole thing doesn't go away, people will reevaluate where a fiscal hawk plausibly belongs in this debate, right? So as long as you can hold out hope that the whole law is going to go away, you might choose not to expand. But eventually, if the law looks like it's got legs, you might change your mind. In terms of the first group, you know, I worked at the Department of Health and Human Services, which is in a building called the Humphrey Building on Independence Avenue in Washington. It's a very ugly building. It looks like a fortress. And in front of it, there's an enormous plaza. And ever since the AIDS epidemic back in the 1980s, there has been a history of people protesting on that plaza. And, you know, all sorts of people with all sorts of health problems come and protest on the plaza. But there has never been, as far as I know, a mass protest on the uninsured. And, you know, you don't have the uninsured marching on Washington. That's because it's not a group of people who consider being uninsured as perhaps the first thing in their lives. It's a group of people who have many, many other issues usually that are of concern to them, like low incomes or health problems that are already fighting. And so you don't have a massive sort of self-advocacy group among the uninsured. Plus, it's a very it's a population that churns. People don't remain uninsured forever. And so they might just think, well, I'll get out of it. So it's very hard to have advocacy of that type. The main advocates that we've seen for the Medicaid expansion have been providers who serve that population and who realize that their potential to be compensated for that service and even to provide appropriate care is jeopardized by failing to take the expansion.
If you're just joining us, this is Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Sherry Gleed, who is Dean of the Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service at New York University. And from 2010 to 2012, she served as Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation in the Department of Health and Human Services, working on regulations and analysis implementing the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. And we're talking about Medicaid expansion as to why some states would opt out or choose not to opt in at this point. And so you mentioned providers as being probably the main constituency who is rallying
right
behind Medicaid. And I should point out that you probably mean, you know, physicians individually, but also hospitals or key providers,
hospitals,
right?
Particularly yeah. Hospitals.
Yeah, so I've seen a lot of literature, I would say, in the lay press particularly, or I guess in health affairs blogs and journal about predictions of imminent demise, specifically of rural hospitals, but also hospitals that do, you know, what they call disproportionate share of care for the uninsured or, uncompensated care. And I think that's a very real problem. And I think, like in my own state in Oklahoma, I know that the Oklahoma Hospital Association signed on to the Affordable Care Act and very much hope that the legislation would bring them needed revenue to keep some of their smaller member hospitals alive. And since our governor and legislature has chosen not to expand, you know, they're really struggling right now.
No, I think that's right. It's going to be really tough. I don't know what's going to happen. We'll see whether the dish cuts actually wind up taking place. But these are payments that are supposed to go to hospitals to cover the uninsured and low-income populations. We'll see what happens.
Was there a two-year reprieve granted or something?
They are trying to, they're making the allocations simpler. They're not going to make the big reductions in 2014 and 15, but we'll see.
So I want to look back at your time as Assistant Secretary. So this was from 2010 to 2012. Now, the legislation passed, it was in March of 2010. So did you,
right.
when did you assume the position?
In July, the beginning of July. So things were pretty chaotic because you'll remember that the legislation passed in this funky way because of Scott Brown's election in Massachusetts, and it didn't really pass until March, and then there were actually deadlines in the legislation that were before March. So by the time the legislation had passed, the department was already behind on meeting its deadlines. There was nothing they could have done. They can't do anything until the legislation has passed, but the deadlines were written assuming that it would all pass in January. So the first few months were pretty chaotic. There were some provisions that were supposed to go into place very quickly, like the provision allowing young adults to be on their parents' insurance coverage, the provisions that regulated the loss ratios for insurance companies. A big new high-risk pool was set up across the country very quickly to enroll people with pre-existing conditions. So there was a lot. It was pretty chaotic to get all of that going. And then if you think about the federal government, it doesn't really have extra people on hand to do whatever task Congress might dream up. So there were physically no people to do all of this stuff, right? I mean, you can't just hire people in an instant or let contracts in a moment. So it was a very busy and exciting time.
Wow. So the pressure must have been absolutely enormous. And did you spend...
Of course. It was also politically contentious, right? So it was not in any sense easy.
Was the first part of your tenure there just hiring up, as it were, trying to find capable people who could assess and implement
policies? Did some of that. I mean, we did not hire a lot of people. I think one of the striking things, which hasn't really come out yet, is how few people the federal government actually hired to implement the Affordable Care Act. It's a very small number. Most of the work, as we're learning to our chagrin, was done by contractors because the federal government has a hard time hiring people, actually. There are very complex hiring procedures. So once in a while, there would be a brief period when there was a respite. The Office of Personnel Management would say, we understand you guys have a real problem. You can hire for 30 days under an expedited hiring procedure. But much of the time, it was a very slow process. And relatively few people were hired on to do all this work. So people were working very hard.
And you mentioned, for example, one of the most popular aspects of the law is that, you know, young people up to age 26 can stay on their parents' insurance. Well, take us through that as a matter of policymaking. I mean, it sounds like you could snap your fingers and just say it will be so. But, you know, what actually has to happen in order for that to take place?
Well, as a formal matter, the department has to release regulations explaining who must do this, for example. What is a health insurance policy? Under what kinds of policies would this kind of provision be required? How do you define a dependent? All of those arcane details that will explain what's going on. And there's a pretty complicated process, of course, to do all of that. And then somebody has to enforce the regulation. Somebody has to figure out, for example, if you were hired into a job last week, can you put your adult kids on your policy today? Or is there a waiting period? Is there many, many details need to be ironed out and thought through. And then if you're a 24-year-old or a parent of a 24-year-old and your employer won't cover your child, who do you complain to and under what authority? So all of these details need to be figured out.
Wow.
Nothing is simple.
And so as an economist, are those fun things for you to ponder over? Because obviously there's an economic impact, and doing that analysis may be in your wheelhouse, but then I guess actually settling on the rules may be more arcane or even, you know, certainly contentious.
So it turns out that every regulation that the department, that any department in the federal government puts out, has to have accompanying it something called a regulatory impact analysis, which estimates the cost and benefits of that regulation. So even for something as straightforward as how many young adults do you put on, you know, what happens to young adults? We had to do estimates. How many young adults might be affected? How many might be expected to gain insurance? Will those people drop insurance they already have and switch to their parents' policies? How much will it cost? What is the effect likely to be on insurance premiums? So even for something that seems like it's just a no-brainer and it's totally straightforward, there's actually a fair amount of analytic work that needs to be done as a matter of public procedure. So if you read the Federal Register, because you have terrible insomnia and you wind up reading the Federal Register, you will see that every regulation actually has a cost-benefit analysis that accompanies it.
And how, taking the big step back, I mean, I remember hearing a lot about Cass Sunstein in the early Obama mm-hmm. administration heading
right.
up OIRA, the Office of Regulatory Administration, I guess, whose essentially job it was to review lots of government regulation, and he became
right.
sort of a favorite whipping boy of Fox News and things like that. But how long have we had that requirement that cost-benefit analyses be attached to legislation?
It might be the Reagan administration. It might be the first Bush administration. So it's quite a long time. And Cass ran that office. Every time we did one of these assessments to say how much will it cost and what are the benefits will be, it had to be reviewed by that office. So they made sure that it was okay or legitimate or met their standards before the regulation could go out. So, yes, there's an elaborate structure to do this.
And, for example, on the young person, the 26 and under being on their parents' insurance, how do you get the data to make your estimates? I mean, how do you, is it just back of the envelope math? And is, I mean, where are you pulling from census data? Are you pulling from marketing
yes.
data?
So there is an annual survey, the current population survey, that asks people, a large sample of people, 60,000 households, maybe more than that now, a whole bunch of questions, including who's in the household and what do they do and do they have health insurance and so on. So from that, we could calculate how many young adults lived in a there were who might be covered by such policies. But it took a little bit of doing, because if you have a young adult who doesn't live with you, we'd have to figure out that they're attached to you, and that's not an obvious, you see how that would not be obviously easy to do, because they're
yes.
a separate household. So, yeah, you try to pull together whatever data you can to make the best estimates you can. We were actually pretty good on that one.
Huh. And so you say you're pretty good. I mean, your estimate of what the impact would be was pretty much on the mark as far as what
kind
of uptake.
We were actually a little low. We thought it would be a little fewer, slightly fewer people than there were, and actually the take-up on that policy was astonishingly high and very fast.
And so that being then a reflection of sort of how simple it was to understand, sort of like if you have kids this age, you can put them on your insurance, and the sort of very quick appeal of that, right? I mean, so the popularity.
I think so. And one of the things that we have learned, and I think we are also learning even in the sign-ups for the exchanges, is that it is true that young people are not very concerned about risk and don't take much care of themselves, but most of them still have parents. And their parents are more sensible and say, you know, you really need to have health insurance. So this was a good policy because the decision-making was in the hands of 40- and 50-year-olds and not in the hands of 20-year-olds. So it moved fast.
I also want to ask you, your time as Assistant Secretary, I mean, you mentioned the tremendous time pressure you were under as well as the political pressures. What else were some of the competing pressures? I mean, I can't imagine coming into a job where you were already essentially past deadline on several parts of the law. And you mentioned, too, just the workforce was not something that was readily expandable. So people just worked very hard. I mean, what kind of hours did you keep? And, you know, was this a 7-day-a-week job?
So it was in some ways a good thing that my family stayed in New York. I could work all the time while I was in Washington, and nobody missed me. I came home on the weekend. So, you know, when I was there, I was working pretty much. And a lot of the staff were as well. I think the other thing to really recognize, of course, is that the Affordable Care Act was by no means the only thing that Health and Human Services was doing over this period. So our office and many of the other offices, you know, the secretary and other people, dealt with all of HHS, and that includes the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and the Indian Health Service and the Health Resources and Services Administration, which does community health centers and health workforce training, and the Food and Drug Administration. So while we were doing all of this and many other things, we were doing work on tobacco regulation that the Food and Drug Administration had just been empowered to do. So there was a bunch of work there, and food safety regulations that the Food and Drug Administration was doing, and the CDC had some concerns. So there was a lot of other stuff going on. The Administration on Children and Families, which does TANF, you know, the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. So we had a lot of people working on things that were not the Affordable Care Act either. Business as usual continued, as well as all the Medicare changes that were happening. So it was a very busy place.
Right. So it's the, I guess, analogy I've heard some use of fixing, or in this case, probably building the airplane while you're in mid-flight. You know, you're building
exactly.
a whole new airplane.
Building and assessing the airplane while you're in mid-flight.
Of course, assessing, exactly, like an economist would. If you're just joining us, this is Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Sherry Gleed, who's a healthcare economist. She's the dean of the Robert F. Wagner Graduate School of Public Service at New York University. And from 2010 to 2012, she was the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation in the Department of Health and Human Services. And I would be remiss if I did not ask you about healthcare.gov. You mentioned previously that a lot of the federal government, it's very difficult to hire people, for example, in the federal government because the hiring process is complex. I've also, in I guess some of the flap about healthcare.gov, read that the contracting process is somewhat complex as well, but that it sounds like it's easier than at least hiring people, outsourcing it, as it were. So tell us, I mean, what from where you sat and where you sit now, you know, what were some of the lessons learned and what were the pressures you were under?
So, I mean, I think it is important to realize that both the federal hiring process and the federal contracting process are primarily designed to ensure that there won't be any corruption or unethical conduct or things like that in contracting and hiring. So, like, the number one issue that you have to be careful about is that the process be very regimented and rule-bound, because you're really worried that somebody's going to do a favor for their nephew, or that a senator is going to call and get you to give this contract to one of his constituents, right? So if you actually start off by worrying first about the ethics of the thing and only then about how well it works, you're going to wind up in a situation where sometimes you wind up with people who are perfectly ethical, but the job might not get done. And I think that's not a shocking outcome. It's a deliberate outcome. The other thing I think in terms of healthcare.gov is that I think it's fair to say that no one who was working on it had any idea of how difficult it was going to be. And I think the thing that has really come out only over time is that it's not only the federal government website that didn't work, but websites in Oregon, in Massachusetts, which has had health reform for a long time now, in Hawaii, in Maryland, these websites also did not work at all, even worked worse than healthcare.gov. So part of the problem here is it just turned out to be a much harder problem than people thought it was going to be.
And interestingly, though, I mean, the turnaround, I think, in the improvement has been, I mean, when you look at it with a slightly longer view, it's been fantastic. I mean, it's been absolutely how quickly, you know, the fire was put out, so to speak.
I mean, I think that, you know, one of the lessons I take away from this is that one of the things the government needs to learn how to do is how to do a website launch or how to do a consumer-facing electronic launch. I mean, if we look at how other consumer-facing websites launch new products, they tend to do it in a much more incremental way, either with beta versions or with very limited offerings at first until they get the bugs out. And people are kind of accustomed to that. You're sort of used to the idea that when Windows or whoever sends out a new operating system, it's going to be months until it's working properly. Here, I think, you know, people were still of the view that it was going to be like a car, and when it came off the assembly line, it would run. That's probably just not the right way to think about it.
Well, I guess the necessity of the timing and the implementation of the law going live, I guess, at least for the exchange part of it, on January 1, 2014, meant that it had to be ready to roll by October 1st. Had we had another year, do you think it would have made a difference, or was it the forced crucible?
No, I don't think it was that. I think what they could have said on October 1st is, we are launching the beta version of healthcare.gov. There are going to be a lot of glitches, and we'll be working this out so that the whole thing is working by January 1, 2014. And then they would have done exactly what they did, but it would have played out differently. You know, the communications piece of it would have been different. Instead of saying to people, you know, the shiny new rocket is going to take off and reach the moon, you'd say, this is the first version. We expect to be updating it every week. You know, if you want to try it right away, go ahead, but this is going to be improving over time. And what we commit to is that by January 1st, 2014, you'll be able to enroll. And that's what happened, in fact. But instead of looking like a success, it looked like a failure, even though the same set of objective circumstances could have been interpreted as a success.
Right. So how you tell the story, and just setting people's expectations, because definitely the expectation, I think the marketing, you know, was off, was people were led to believe, hey, this thing is going to work, and expectations were vastly defied. So you mentioned that your family remained behind in New York, where previously you had been teaching at Columbia, and you went and worked in the government. And so how did that job come about?
Well, it was completely unexpected. I've been a health economist for a long time, and I actually started in healthcare policy. I worked for the first Bush administration back in 1992, and I wound up staying on in Washington and working on the Clinton health reform. I was on a one-year leave from the university, so I spent the first 6 months working for the Republicans and the second 6 months working for the Dems. And then I returned to Columbia, and I've had a career as a healthcare policy analyst and researcher since then. But I never was involved in politics at all. In fact, I'm Canadian. I didn't even become a U.S. Oh, now I'm American, but I was Canadian, and I didn't become a U.S. citizen until 2001. 2002, one or the other. So I wasn't even an American, so I was not, you know, naturally involved in politics. But I kept doing research, and I worked with a number of colleagues. And then when the Obama administration came in, you may remember that Tom Daschle was had been initially selected to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. He had a colleague who had worked with him for some years, a woman who co-wrote a book with him, and she had written papers with me, one or two papers earlier, several years earlier, 5-6 years earlier, and I got a call out of the blue, actually an email saying, would you like this job? And I pretty much fell out of my chair. I was just shocked. I did not expect it at all, but it's a fabulous job, so I was very excited.
And you were able to do it, you said, for 2 years, and then, you know, it was hard to be away from your family, and so you returned to New York City in a new role. But do you miss the assistant secretary's position or working at HHS? And
I do. I mean, I love my job now, and it's wonderful working with students again, and it's exciting to be leading an organization. But there is something about working in the policy process that's really special. I think if you have the chance to do it, it's very exciting. It's very exciting to feel like the things that you're doing every day could matter to millions of people. I mean, it's scary because so much weight is on you, but it fills you with adrenaline, right? And I had fabulous colleagues. You know, I mean, both the staff who worked for me, who were great and so dedicated and so hardworking, but also the people who had come from all around the country to work for the administration on implementing health care reform and the other initiatives, they were so committed and so collegial. It was just a delightful work atmosphere.
How did you get interested in economics in the first place, and then more specifically, I guess, in health economics?
Everything I ever did was accidental, I have to tell you. I had a teacher in high school who taught geography, and she added a unit on economic geography, and I thought, oh, this is so cool, I really like this. And I went off to college, and I studied economics, and then I didn't think that there were any jobs for economists, so I went to law school for a year, and I dropped out and did a master's in economics and decided I loved it, and went off to do a PhD in economics, and I wanted to be a labor economist. I wrote my dissertation about the labor market impact of the HIV epidemic, and I finished in late 1980s, at which time there had been kind of a 10-year hiatus in thinking about healthcare economics because it was the end of the Reagan administration, and there just had been nothing really happening. I mean, the introduction of DRGs, which was a really big deal, but mostly a pretty quiet period in healthcare. So there were not a lot of healthcare economists on the job market, and a lot of people looked at my dissertation and said, HIV, oh, you're a healthcare economist. So I was hired as a healthcare economist, and the first time I taught healthcare economics was the first time I had opened a textbook in healthcare economics. I didn't know anything about it. So I learned it, and then I had this chance to go to Washington and work for the Bush administration. So, you know, it's really been, as my path changed, I followed it, and I took opportunities, which was great. It's been an extremely satisfying career.
Oh, that's a great story. You mentioned the DRG. Can you explain a little bit about what that is for listeners?
Sure. So the big initiative, let me just step back a little bit. Richard Nixon actually proposed a plan for national health insurance. It was actually not very different from the plan that just passed. But at any rate, he did it just as Watergate was imploding, and then he left, and he was impeached and all that, and then Gerald Ford came in, and he wasn't really going to deal with domestic policy. And then Jimmy Carter came in. There was inflation, you'll remember. There was a big focus on trying to keep costs down in the face of inflation, but there wasn't a lot of interest in Congress in going much further with healthcare policy. And then Reagan came in, and his concern was to keep the costs under control. And the big initiative that happened in that period, which was an important one, is that Medicare changed the way it paid hospitals. Before that period, it had paid hospitals based on cost of care or on a per diem basis, but in the mid-1980s, they implemented a system where Medicare is paid a flat sum based on the diagnosis code of the person who is admitted. So if you admit a patient with a heart attack, you are given a flat amount of money to care for that patient. And if that patient dies on the first day and incurs very few costs, you still get that amount of money. And if they stay in the hospital for 45 days and incur huge costs, that's still the amount of money you get. So this is called the DRG payment system, or prospective payment. Since then, it's been adopted by very many countries around the world. I think it's proved to be one of the most successful initiatives in American healthcare policy, actually.
Did the DRG system actually flatten the cost curve of Medicare, or the spending curve, as it were? We talk about the cost curve.
It's a question of whether it did at the time of its introduction. It certainly reduced length of stay in hospitals and probably shifted a lot of costs out of hospitals and into other settings. But I would say that rather than thinking about it as bending the cost curve in itself, it may have encouraged smarter, more efficient behavior by hospitals, and it allowed the government to budget health care more effectively, because otherwise they really had very little control over how much was spent on a case. Now, other countries have adopted it because it also gives hospitals an incentive to actually get people in and out, which is a good thing. You want hospitals to admit patients if they need to be admitted, and that's a problem that some other countries have had. So it turns out to be a pretty effective mechanism for hospital payment.
So I was wondering if you have predictions that you'd be willing to share about the Affordable Care Act. Namely, I guess, number one, do you think that it will dramatically reduce the number of uninsured Americans as the law was really designed to do? I mean, do you think we'll get there with 20 to 30 million more covered individuals?
I expect that we will. I mean, the experience that we base those projections on is the experience of other cases where we've tried to do expansions like this. And in all those other cases, we've seen that kind of take up. We saw it in Massachusetts. We saw it in Tennessee when they did the expansion. I mean, we see this kind of participation. Most people actually want to have health insurance, and they're actually willing to pay some amount of money for it. So if you can get the price of health insurance into a range that they feel that they can afford, a lot of people will take it up. So I'm fairly optimistic. I don't know exactly what the time scale of this will be, whether we'll get there in 1 year or 2 years or 3 years, but I do believe, as somebody who spends a lot of money on health insurance, that it's a valuable thing and people would like to have it if they can get it. So I'm fairly confident about that one.
How confident are you that in the long run, or in the short, medium, and long run, that the Affordable Care Act will, in fact, bend the cost curve, as I guess Orszag or whoever it was, or Atul Gawande in his piece, you know, talked about healthcare driving discretionary spending in the U.S.?
One of the things I think is really interesting is that the U.S. spends so much more money, I mean, just dramatically more money than any other country on healthcare. In fact, we spend so much money on healthcare that even though only about half our health budget is paid by the government, our government spends more on healthcare than almost any other government does per capita. So we are extremely expensive on both the public side and the private side. And our outcomes are not great and getting worse relative to other countries over time. So all of that suggests to me that there is definitely room to save a lot of money in the healthcare system. It's much harder to figure out exactly how to do that, but it surely is a mixture of pushing negotiations to keep prices lower and trying to have more sane use of resources so that utilization changes as well. All of that is eminently doable because virtually every other country in the world has succeeded in doing it, and we can't really be that much less effective than all those other countries. I don't believe that Americans, I think Americans are an ingenious people, a very competitive people. You know, this is a nation that has managed to make almost everything else available at higher quality and less cost than is often the case in other places, and yet we are so pathetically lousy at doing it in healthcare. I just don't think that's going to last. So we'll see.
I
think we will bend the cost curve somehow.
Okay, that's good. I like your optimism. I think the last part I want to ask you about is in terms of some of the innovation in the Affordable Care Act, or CMMI was created, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And, for example, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I practice, we're one of seven national pilot sites for something called CPCI, Comprehensive Primary Care Initiative, where we get funding in advance per patient. So we get anywhere from $20 to $40, depending on the age and, I guess, comorbidities of the patient. That money, that funding has allowed us to hire more nurses to do care coordination,
mm-hmm. Right.
And to do phone calls and even some in-person visits with our highest-risk patients. These are patients who frequently go to the emergency department or who are hospitalized frequently and are at high risk for being readmitted. And I have to say, even it's early, we're still in, I think, the first year of our four-year demonstration project. It's definitely made an impact for our patients, just anecdotally. And then certainly I train residents as well who work in the setting. They've seen an impact in terms of getting preventive services to some of the highest risk patients. And I think we don't quite have the data yet, but avoiding some hospital readmissions.
Mm-hmm.
So do you see, I mean, outpatient medicine still seems so fractious where we still pretty much work on a fee-for-service model, I think, in the majority of cases, but will we be able to, I guess, shift toward this value-based model where we essentially are paying more for quality of healthcare than we are for quantity, you know, discrete episodes of care, the way most, you know, healthcare encounters are still paid for?
Well, I think that we will have to, and so we will. And I also think that this is a place where technological changes in the broader world will facilitate doing it. So as we move to more electronic health records, smartphones, all of that good stuff, there will be entrepreneurial, in a positive sense, thinking, you know, practices that will say, you know, we could do all of this as you're doing in a much better way. We can provide people with better service. We can care for them more effectively, and it doesn't need to cost us more. And in fact, it could cost us less. You know, that's very likely to be the wave of the future. Why should people put up with having, I mean, look at it from the other perspective. Forget about the cost perspective. Think about it as a patient. When you're being shuffled off from one doctor to another, in and out of the hospital, this is a very unpleasant experience of care. Clearly, we can do better than that.
Sherry Gleed is a health economist and currently dean of the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University. From 2010 to 2012, she served in the Obama administration as the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation at Health and Human Services. You're listening to Medical Matters, a show that demystifies medical news and health policy in the United States. Critics of Obamacare, and there are many, deride the program as contributing to a nanny state, the idea that the government is impinging on our freedoms to make personal choices. Essentially, the government is coddling us or treating us like babies. Here with some thoughts on the nanny state is Janet Pearson with a commentary.
50-something years ago, when I was a little girl, about the only protection a kid had from serious injury in the event of a car accident was your mother's long right arm. Parents back then perfected the practice of simultaneously slamming on the brakes, maneuvering the car, and holding a toddler or two in place with one arm when danger arose on the road. This was no easy task, because back then, standing in the seat was the preferred mode of travel for youngsters. A tot could take in a lot more of the passing surroundings that way. While the mid-20th century posed its share of risks to kids, they paled when compared to what children in early-day America faced. A few centuries ago, it was not only legal but common for children to drink alcoholic beverages along with the rest of the family. There's ample evidence, in fact, that this practice was the norm in colonial America. In her book, Taverns and Drinking in Early America, Sharon V. Salinger writes, "Colonists of every rank, size, and age, including children, drank often and in quantity." One Virginia traveler wrote of the vile practice of giving children, as well as those of all other ages, rum in the morning as soon as they rise, and the parents encourage it, reckoning it wholesome. And we thought sugary cereals were a bad way to start the day. But even way back then, government regulation was more than just a controversial concept. Local colonial leaders decided that drinking was a threat to their control and an attack on an orderly society, and so they set about regulating the tavern culture and limiting the number that could be in business. Local and state measures that strictly regulated public houses sprouted and proliferated. Seems government nannyism has deep roots in American culture. Thanks in part to this long history of the government looking out for us, children are no longer reliant on their parents' arm strength to keep them safe on the road, and they sure don't get a sippy cup of rum in the morning to get their day started out right. Of course, it's obvious why these are no longer common practices, along with a host of others that are now relegated to the history books. Experience taught us the dangers of such practices, and society took steps to reduce or even try to eliminate the dangers. Government control when it comes to matters such as health and public safety has been a mainstay of American democracy since its beginning, it turns out. The results can be seen all around us, all day, every day. People don't smoke cigarettes in elevators and movie theaters and airplanes anymore. People don't regularly die or become seriously ill from eating tainted food or drinking unsafe water. Seatbelt usage, now mandated, is the rule rather than the exception. If government had not ventured into the realm of controlling such significant dangers, would we Americans have taken these problems on all by ourselves? It's doubtful we'd have had the will or the way. Can anyone imagine parents uniting in large numbers to try to develop a better way of protecting their children than the fully extended right arm? Why, seatbelts weren't even envisioned way back then, much less a specialized car seat to keep toddlers safely immobilized within a vehicle. So the question isn't whether government can and should regulate certain behaviors. but how much our everyday practices should be regulated. And while this topic is almost always controversial and almost always elicits howls of nanny state interference, the record on this front seems to suggest Americans are okay with some government regulation and that they can and will dictate how much is too much. There is, I would suggest, a sort of regulatory marketplace out there that limits how much control Americans are willing to allow to be forced upon themselves. Are some soda pops too big? Americans don't seem to think much regulation of the sale of sugary beverages is warranted, so that idea hasn't gained much traction. What about trans fats? That's another matter. The Food and Drug Administration's recent announcement that it plans to phase out artificial trans fats from the American food supply over time has generally been met with positive responses, and with good reason. Eliminating trans fats could prevent as many as 7,000 heart disease deaths a year, it's estimated. But just because control of a dangerous substance seems like a good idea, that doesn't mean it's a done deal. There's been a movement to adopt much tighter controls on tobacco sales for years, but in spite of that product's proven deadliness, the proposed controls haven't advanced. Again, the marketplace has made it known what the regulatory tolerance levels are when it comes to tobacco. So anyone who's virulently opposed to more government control of personal behaviors needn't lose too much sleep over the issue. If it's a good enough idea, one that is justifiable and draws majority support, there's a pretty good chance a law will go on the books. If not, then it's probably not going to happen. For centuries, that approach seems to have worked pretty well for Americans. Maybe having a nanny around some other time isn't such a bad idea after all.
Janet Pearson, formerly of the Tulsa World, spent nearly four decades in the newspaper business and is now branching into other media. You've been listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our program is recorded and produced in the studios of KWGS Public Radio Tulsa at the University of Tulsa. Medical Matters is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. Our theme music is by Europa 51. Original music by Scott Griffith. Join us next week as our topic is the emerging neuroscience of the adolescent brain. For more information, check out our blog, glasshospital.com. Just click on the Medical Matters tab up in the upper right. Or send us an email, glasshospital@gmail.com.